Well, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The last oral case on our calendar today is A21-0941, State of Minnesota versus Anthony Barrett Graham. Council are familiar with our Zoom process here, I believe. You'll each have 15 minutes for your argument and an additional will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can see the clock in the grid view. If you have any trouble seeing that, let us know. We are recording the oral argument here today. The recording will be available on our website within 24 hours or so. And I'll just remind anyone who's watching that we do not allow other recordings of our oral arguments except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. I'll just ask that you identify yourself and the party you represent for the recording.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amy Lawler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent Anthony Graham in this appeal. The primary issue in this case, and the one I'd like to focus on today, is the intelligence of Graham's guilty pleas. We look to Graham at the time he pled guilty. We examine under the line of cases of State v. Trott and those other cases that establish the standard for whether he understood the rights he waived by pleading guilty and understood the consequences of his guilty pleas. If his pleas were not intelligent, then it was a manifest injustice, and he would be entitled to withdraw his pleas.
I've never seen the argument that you're advancing that his guilty plea was unintelligent because he did not understand that by pleading guilty, he would waive his right to hire a civil lawyer to challenge evidence against him in civil court. And I couldn't find any case law that's even something that's possible.
And I actually looked to a case that you offered from earlier this month, Judge Riley, in State v. Moran, because I think it is instructive. And you're right that there has not been a case that specifically addresses the fact pattern of understanding the distinction between criminal and civil cases. But I do think that there certainly have been cases that address the question of intelligence with respect to what rights a defendant believes he is maintaining and what rights he believes he has waived.
There's lots of case law that if a defendant pleads guilty thinking he can still challenge the evidence, the suppression issues, that's not intelligent, which is what Moran was about in a number of our other cases.
Sure. And I think that the steps that the Moran analysis takes are the same ones we should follow here. And I think it does lead to the same result, because ultimately it's a question of a situation where in Moran and in this case, Mr. Graham, they both had a suppression issue that was personally important to them. And at the time they pled guilty, there was nothing on the record to indicate that they were maintaining that right. There was nothing that at the time of the plea hearing was placed on the record to indicate they could continue to vindicate their suppression rights by any vehicle, whether that would be a direct appeal or by a civil process or by some other method, by court of equity. You know, there's nothing in the record that would indicate that that was a right that was specifically maintained. At the same time, though, in both cases, there was not a specific line of questioning in the plea colloquy or otherwise placed on the record relating to what would happen to those suppression issues.
Mr. Graham did sign a plea petition, mm-hmm. and in that plea petition, it specifically states that his attorney told him, and he understands that the prosecutor in the case against him has physical evidence obtained as a result of searching and seizing the evidence, that he has a right to a pretrial hearing before a judge to determine whether or not the evidence the prosecution has could be used against him if the case went to trial. And he checked that he does not request such a pretrial hearing, and he's waiving that right. So it appears that he understood he gave up that right in terms of his criminal prosecution. And so I guess I'm struggling to understand why his waiver isn't intelligent when that is really the right that is at issue for purposes of his conviction and his guilty plea.
And I think that that language, that wording is crucial. During the plea colloquy, the district court asked if he understood you have the right to challenge the state's evidence in pretrial hearings. You're giving up that right. But then there was no further inquiry into whether there was another vehicle or another forum in which he could challenge that evidence. And I think
obviously— But how would that vehicle or forum affect the criminal proceeding? Unless it would affect the criminal proceeding, it would be collateral.
And I think that is actually what goes to the question of intelligence. In his, to his understanding, to someone who has not attended law school and doesn't understand the distinction, there was another route that he would take to vindicate his civil rights. And that would be by hiring the civil rights attorney or challenging it in civil court, as he understood his attorney was advising him to do. And I think that's—
And so for purposes of that argument, that goes to vindicating his civil rights, not to whether he is guilty or whether that evidence could be used against him in a criminal proceeding.
But it also goes to intelligence. And I think that's the key.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Anna. I'm sorry. The standard for intelligence doesn't go to the question of whether that the client's, the defendant's understanding is legally accurate. It doesn't go to the question of whether it was a widely held understanding. It really just goes to the question of, do you understand what you're giving up here? And he didn't. And he said that very clearly in his affidavit, that he understood that what his attorney's advice was about going to hire a civil attorney meant that he could continue to challenge the evidence against him in a different forum. And there hasn't been a lot of case law on this, obviously, and obviously his understanding was not correct, but it is what he understood at that moment. And so I think this also goes to kind of a corollary question of whether, you know, the relief we're seeking is obviously the right to plea withdrawal, but it's also a question of whether there's an alternate remedy here, which would be a remand for the post-conviction hearing that Mr. Graham had requested and that the district court denied. And the district court denied.
In terms of that question, let's look at his affidavit, though, because I assume you're relying on paragraph 5 of his affidavit to support your argument.
Yes.
And I don't see how that says what you're saying it says. I mean, I don't see how that paragraph where it says, when I, Anthony Barrett Graham, directed this information 1-4 to my attorney, Amy Brooks, she stated, and I quote, "Do you know how big the Constitution is? It's like this big. I'm a criminal defense attorney. If you need a civil one, hire one." But that doesn't discuss any specific rights he might have. It's just a kind of vague, obscure statement in my view, but help me understand why I'm wrong.
Yeah, and I think, so that was his affidavit that he attached to the plea petition. And then instead of ordering an evidentiary hearing, the post-conviction court ordered memoranda. And so we did then file a memoranda in which he then attached his pro se memoranda in which he offered additional explanation as to what he understood that meant, including the line, which is, the attachment is ultimately page 21 of that memoranda, where it says, although petitioner accepted a plea in regards to the files listed in this complaint, he believed he was supposed to challenge his warrantless and unreasonable search and seizure claims in civil court, where he filed these claims in December of 2020, just weeks after accepting his plea. And so, you know, I think this ultimately goes to the question of if this court does not believe that there is sufficient evidence in the record to indicate that Mr. Graham lacked an understanding as to what his guilty plea meant and what rights he was giving up, I think at minimum, it would need to remand for that evidentiary hearing he had requested to further develop the question of what he understood his attorney was telling him about this civil vehicle to challenge the searches and seizures, and why he believed that he still maintained that right even after pleading guilty. And I think he was doing the best he could to not only explain this in his affidavit and in his memorandum to the court, but also the fact that he did file those civil claims shortly after pleading guilty in civil court would, I think, further indicate that he really believed that he had this right to continue challenging the searches and seizures and raising those evidentiary claims in a different way. And regardless of whether that was accurate or not.
It looks like your client was quite active criminally during this period of time. And I don't know what the record indicates with regard to his criminal history, if this was his first go around.
No, it's not.
So it's not like he's coming to the proceedings never having seen them before.
No, but I think obviously every case is different. And in this case, there were some fairly meritorious search and seizure issues here, including a challenge to a warrantless arrest and challenging the discovery disclosures of the CRI. And in this case, he pled guilty before the district court ruled. And I actually think that this is something that makes his case even stronger than the Moran case, because in Moran, the defendant had received, you know, an evidentiary decision, a decision on the merits of his evidentiary claims. And here, Mr. Graham hadn't gotten that. He pled guilty before he received the decision, and he believed that there was some other vehicle in which he could still receive that decision on the lawfulness of the search and seizure or on the lawfulness of the state declining to disclose the identity of the CRI. And so that, I think that does make a factual difference. It is a distinction because, you know, in a lot of cases, the defendant comes to the plea hearing having already received the ruling from the court. Here, he thought that there was a different way to get the ruling that he hadn't yet received. And to the extent that the court believes that the evidentiary record is perhaps inconclusive or not fully developed, I think that is a further indicator that at minimum, this is not a case where you would simply affirm, but would rather remand for that evidentiary hearing because the post-conviction court should have then held the hearing to allow Mr. Graham to develop the record and to explain why he believes that and to resolve any other questions then, including about why someone who has some experience in the criminal justice system believed that this case and this advice that he received from his attorney meant that the case could proceed differently than it had in the past.
And you didn't argue ineffective assistance of counsel in your post-conviction relief petition, correct?
No, Mr. Graham did raise that in his pro se filings, both to the district court and to the court of appeals, but I did not. I believe that this case can be squarely resolved under the question of the intelligence. Ultimately, I don't think it matters what either his attorney or the district court specifically said to him that led him to this misunderstanding, this misapprehension. Ultimately, I think what matters is that he had it, that he misunderstood at the time of the plea hearing what rights he was giving up and what rights he would be able to continue to vindicate. And that ultimately is what led his plea to be unintelligent. And
can I ask you, you mentioned that he raised ineffective assistance of counsel in his pro se filing with the district court and before this court. It appears in the district court's order that it did not address the issues he raised in his pro se filing at the post-conviction stage. I think the district court said in its order that the court will not consider any issues, claims, or arguments in documents written and filed by defendant. Defendant cannot simultaneously be represented by counsel and represent himself in district court proceedings. Do you agree with the district court's conclusion with regard to his pro se filing in district court?
I don't, but I also don't think it matters. Ultimately, this court reviews all of the legal claims de novo and all of the legal conclusions made by the post-conviction court de novo. Mr. Graham would be allowed to raise ineffective assistance for the first time, even if there had not been a post-conviction proceeding, even if this were simply on direct appeal without any proceedings below. And he's asking you to make that decision based on the record that was established both through the rounds of the initial proceedings as well as at the time of the post-conviction filings. So based on that factual record, I think you can reach those legal conclusions de novo as to whether or not Mr. Graham's attorney was ineffective. Where I do think it would matter, though, is ultimately in either case, this court would benefit from an additional development of the record with respect to what Mr. Graham was told and what he understood. And I think that's particularly important because the Moran decision, for example, highlighted what came after, what words were said at the sentencing hearing, for example. But the ultimate question in Moran and here was what the defendant understood at the time of the plea hearing. And in Moran, no one had specifically told him on the record at the time or before the plea hearing that he would be allowed to continue to challenge the evidence against him. And yet his plea was still unintelligent. I think here the record is actually a bit stronger about what information Mr. Graham had at the time of the plea hearing that caused him to have a misunderstanding about what rights he could continue to pursue. So we would ask that this court reverse and remand to allow him to withdraw his guilty pleas. But in the alternative, we'd ask that it reverse and remand to allow the additional development of the record to establish what he was told and why he understood that he could continue to pursue these rights in the civil form. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, I'm not sure which attorney is proceeding, but you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jim Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I'm one of the counsel representing the state of Minnesota in this case.
And good morning, Your Honors. I am Heather Jo Schmidt, assistant Mower County attorney, also representing the state in this matter. At this time, we would invite the panel to question the state regarding the issues in its brief, with Mr. Haas responding to questions as to issue one, whether Pellin's plea was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And I will respond to any questions regarding issue two, the length of Appellant's sentence.
Well, I have another question for the two of you, and you can decide who wants to answer. But the appellant, Mr. Graham, did file a pro se petition for post-conviction relief before the district court, and the district court did not address that. And he, in his appellate pro se brief, argues that that was error, that the district court erred by failing to do so. Can you address whether that was, was it error for the district court to fail to do so? I didn't see you address his pro se brief at all in your brief. So I would like the state to address that.
Our position to the post-conviction court was that, unlike the rule of criminal procedure that allows a appellant to file a supplemental pro se brief in addition to, or that's maybe even contrary to the arguments of their appellate attorney, that there's no similar provision in the district court. And our position was that you cannot simultaneously be represented by counsel and be pro se in the district court. Indeed, we litigate this question all the time of people that want to represent themselves or not.
Authority for that, Mr. Haas?
Perhaps just the absence of a rule allowing it, but I would agree that he is entitled to bring this issue up on appeal and has in his supplemental pro se brief. So I guess whether or not the district court erred in not addressing it post-conviction, this court certainly can and should address it.
And you did not address it in your brief.
That's correct.
So we are left with no position from the state on that.
Sure. Our position first is that by, failing to really to support his argument with any legal argument that it's forfeited, and we see this oftentimes in pro se appeals. But as to the substance of it, again, our position is that it's not a meritorious claim. In his affidavit attached to the petition for post-conviction relief, previously, the court read in that paragraph 5 about the claims of what his lawyer said. On its face, assuming everything is true, I don't believe it gives rise to relief under Strickland. I see this scenario as Mr. Graham saying to his lawyer, look, the police violated my constitutional rights. They violated my civil rights. And his trial attorney says to the effect, well, that may be true, And we have the right to challenge the evidence presented against you in these criminal cases in which I represent you. But if you want to accept the plea offer that the state has laid on the table here, we have to waive those issues in this case. Now, you may have some collateral remedy in a civil lawsuit for damages, and you may wish to pursue that. But to do that, you'd have to hire a civil lawyer and bring a civil lawsuit. But it's beyond the scope of the terms of the agreement here, in which you'd be convicted and go to prison.
But Mr. Huss, you make a coherent, sensical argument about, you know, what went down here. But without a record, without an evidentiary hearing, how can we really assess what happened and whether Mr. Grammarly did have a good and complete understanding of the rights he was giving up?
I guess I would say that if everything he says is true, it does not give rise to legal relief. He doesn't explain what he didn't understand about his criminal case. He signed the Rule 15 petition, as we've discussed. And it wasn't just one of those situations where they're out in the hallway right before the hearing, scratching it out in pen. It was all filled out weeks in advance. He had plenty of time to consider it. He had two separate attorneys. The court, I think, gave a full colloquy on the record and asked him about his rights. If the defendant says, I pleaded guilty to domestic assault. Nobody told me that I couldn't go deer hunting this fall because I can't possess a firearm. My lawyer never told me about that. Well, it's just collateral.
He also arguing that he had ineffective assistance of counsel because his counsel didn't, raise the evidentiary issues before the district court prior to the plea hearing?
Well, clearly he is unhappy about the actions of the police and had issues he had hoped to raise. But again, I think he was clearly advised that by pleading guilty, he's giving up those rights. And I think, as the district court in its order says, if the defendant had expressed any such thoughts, the court would address them. The court is not required, however, to question defendant and search his mind for any legally aberrant ideas or thoughts he may be harboring when taking a guilty plea. The court is only required to question and advise defendant pursuant to Rule 1501 in the law. And if the defendant is harboring any aberrant thoughts, the burden is on the defendant to make those thoughts known to the court. Indeed, if the law allowed a defendant to invalidate his guilty plea by later claiming a misunderstanding about rights or matters outside the requirements of Rule 15 in the law, then the reasons for invalidating a plea would be limited only by a defendant's imagination. I think that sums it up. I guess that's our position.
Well, it would have been helpful if you would have responded in your brief to the pro se brief. We're kind of left with no citation as to whether the district court, whether there was an error by the district court in failing to address his pro se petition at the district court level in the post-conviction proceeding. Is that something that you think there's some authority on other than the absence of the rule? Have you done any research on the issue?
We did some research on it and really couldn't find anything dispositive other than, again, we draw a very bright line when we're trying cases. And we've litigated a number of appeals about people who've waived the right to counsel or wanted advisory counsel. And it's kind of you're either represented by counsel or you're pro se, and you can have advisory counsel, but
little different though, where the direct appeal was stayed and he filed a post-conviction petition, or there was a post-conviction petition?
Well, I guess the remedy to me would be if the court feels that a record should have been made at the post-conviction court, would be to remand it back to Judge Kreitzer and say, put Mr. Graham on the witness stand and hear what he has to say, and maybe his lawyers too. I think that would be the remedy if if the court thinks there's that needs to be done. Our position, I think, is on its face that that Mr. Graham, as either petitioner or appellant, has not alleged facts that, if either in his affidavit or his pleadings, that if true, would give rise to relief. And I think that's effectively what the post-conviction court found. Yes, the post-conviction court didn't address them because they were deemed collateral and contrary, or at least omitted by his own appellate counsel.
Can you address, to that point then, I guess, can you address the affidavit that he filed and Ms. Lawler's argument that the affidavit indicates he didn't understand the rights that he was waiving when he pled guilty?
The affidavit, and we've read paragraph 5 where he talks about his attorney's advice about the size of the Constitution and he'd have to hire a civil lawyer. I think the extent of the factual allegation of his alleged misrepresentation. And I'm not seeing a substantive claim of a misrepresentation about the facts of these criminal cases and the ramifications and consequences of his plea in this case. Now, whether or not his plea has a chilling effect on some collateral civil litigation, I don't know. In fact, when you look up that case in Mensis, or MGA as we have it, there wasn't even a complaint. There was attempts to file informa pauperis proceedings, but I don't even know what claims he seeks and whether there is any effect by his guilty plea on that attempt to seek civil remedies. So, again, I just don't think he's alleged facts that, even if they were true, give rise to relief.
Any further questions from the panel? Okay. All right. Well, thank you to both counsel. Ms. Lawler, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal once the marshal gets the clock set.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the outset of Mr. Haas's argument, he recounted a hypothetical conversation that Mr. Graham might have had with his attorney about what rights he maintained and what rights he waived. And I think Judge Bjorkman's question really hit the nail on the head, that we don't know the details of that conversation. And while Mr. Haas is inviting the court to view the facts in a light that are not particularly favorable to Mr. Graham, as we argued in our brief, the district court, the post-conviction court, when deciding to grant an evidentiary hearing, was required to take his allegations as true and to view them in the light most favorable to Mr. Graham. Post-conviction court isn't supposed to deny a petition without a hearing unless there are no material facts in dispute. And here there were material facts in dispute. And I think at minimum, then, that would require a remand to the district court to hold the evidentiary hearing that Mr. Graham had initially requested. I also wanted to briefly address Judge Cochran's questions about how this court is supposed to handle Mr. Graham's pro se arguments concerning ineffective assistance of counsel. I think Mr. Haas and I are in agreement that there's no question that Mr. Graham is allowed to raise them, and this court should review them de novo under any circumstance, even if his represented counsel chose not to make those arguments. Mr. Graham is still entitled to the full review of those arguments under the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure. But I think, to the extent that there's any question about whether or not Mr. Graham was given the full opportunity to develop the record for those arguments, I think this court should continue to view that question under that broad umbrella established under the line of cases, Anderson, Reed, those that argue and establish that the district court, when sitting as a post-conviction court, is supposed to hold an evidentiary hearing if there is any dispute of material fact. And to the extent that either category of legal arguments relies on that fact pattern and the establishment of those facts, whether that's whether the plea was intelligent or whether Mr. Graham received effective assistance of counsel, this court should remand for the development of that record so that it can fully reach those legal questions de novo. So if there are no further questions from the panel, we would ask that the court simply reverse outright and remand for him to be allowed to withdraw his guilty pleas. But in the alternative, we would ask for that reversal and remand for the additional evidentiary hearing that we had initially requested. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. The matter is submitted, and we appreciate your arguments here today.
Thank you.